Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the SOM TV podcast. My name is Jason Wise. On today's show, we interview a very talented winemaker who has an amazing claim to fame. He made the wine that sold for the largest amount in the history of a regular size bottle at auction, $350,000 for a single bottle of wine. His name is Jesse Katz, and he has a winery called Aperture Winery in Sonoma. I'm going to talk to him about point scores, the value of wine, and more. But first, Jesse is making the first of our two wine pairings with our new film, The Delicacy. He makes a beautiful Chenin and Sauvignon Blanc, and we're pairing that with a recipe made by 3-star Michelin chef and Delicacy cast member Kyle Connaughton from Single Thread Restaurant. That is at somtv.com/winepairings. The Delicacy is our first major motion picture original SOM TV film, and it comes out this Thursday, May 7th. I am very, very excited. So you need something to drink. So grab this wine pairing and drink and watch with us. Without further ado, Jesse Katz. All right, buddy, it's good to be here with you.
Great to be here. Well, I wish we were together, but until then, this, I guess, is the best next thing.
Yeah, this is about, unfortunately, all we got. So, Jesse, you and this is kind of a special thing for me because we were supposed to be doing a premiere of my next feature film, Where You're Sitting, right now.
This weekend.
We were supposed to... Yeah.
Exactly. Right where I'm sitting was kind of going to be the premiere of the new Aperture Hospitality tasting room as well. So we're ready to go, turn the winery into a movie theater, have people walk over here and then do a blowout dinner with Kyle from Single Thread. But right now it's just my private drinking lounge until this is all behind us.
Everywhere we are is our private drinking
yeah,
lounge
exactly.
Right now. I think... Just so people know, the Delicacy was going to premiere at Aperture Winery, and it was going to coincide with this massive opening for you. And just, I mean, it's one of the most beautiful spaces, you know, there is in Northern California from a winery standpoint. And it was the perfect spot. It was truly.
We had it all set up, and it was, yeah. And as you know, the weather out here has been spectacular. So it was perfect timing for everything. We were done on time as far as construction went. And this has been a project that I've been dreaming about for 10 years, back when I started Aperture in 2009, and a project that I've been working on the construction of for over 2 years now. So bittersweet because I'm beyond ecstatic with how everything turned out, and it's even better than I even had dreamt about. And, you know, we will end up doing this at some point. It's just going to be a little bit delayed date.
That's right. But so the film comes out now May 7th on SOM TV, but also we wanted to try to bring a little of this experience to people. So we have two of Jesse's wines and a recipe designed by Chef Kyle Connaughton at Single Thread.
Yeah.
So I want to talk to you. You have some pretty remarkable stuff. Your father was this famous photographer. I want to understand how...
That's
yeah,
all he does.
He still is. Yeah, he still is. But I want to understand, I mean, obviously the name of your winery is Aperture. That's clearly a photography term. How did photography turn into a passion for wine for you? I know this could be a long answer, but...
Yeah, how much time do we have? It's a great question, and because I don't come from a wine background. I'm the first winemaker in my family. My introduction to wine was through my father's and my family's travel. So I've traveled to over 80 countries with my family. And we, when I was about 12 years old, he really got into wine and started doing wine projects. And his very first book ever was called The Portrait of Napa and Sonoma that he did with Robert Mondavi. And his travels, then he did one with Robert Parker in Burgundy, Hugh Johnson in Tuscany, Jane Anson in Bordeaux. And he's now done 16 books, 11 of those books on wine. And as a teenager traveling all over the world with my family, especially those later years, if you're sitting in France and Burgundy and Bordeaux, wherever it may be, and a teenager at the dinner table, they introduce you to wine as part of the food and part of the culture, as in my mind, it should be. So I was very fortunate as a young kid to be introduced to these spectacular wines. And it was very influential for me, especially when we lived in Burgundy. My father would do these projects and it would take him 2 or 3 years because he would want multiple harvests to showcase in these photo books. These are spectacular coffee table books that would also be showcased in galleries and restaurants all over the world. And so he'd want a few different vintages involved in each one of those. So we would always go back and forth, my mom and I, because I was still in school. But any summer break, winter break, any breaks we had, because my dad also wanted to kind of capture all the seasons there as well, we'd be living in these areas. And I remember running around the vineyards of these spectacular chateaus and domains throughout France. And especially in Burgundy, when I was a teenager, it was easy for me to understand that the white wine was almost always Chardonnay, the red wine Pinot Noir, but how vastly different that grape, that varietal could be from the same vintage from village to village. And that essence of that I didn't know how to articulate at the time, but terroir was fascinating to me very, very early on, and how a site could have such a unique distinction to the final product. So after I graduated high school in Colorado, I went out to school in California in Santa Barbara just because I didn't know what I wanted to do, and I wanted to be by the ocean, and then I needed a summer job, and I was fascinated with wine, but never in my wildest dreams did I think I could be a winemaker, because it seemed like it had to be passed down generation to generation almost. And so I needed a summer job, and I wanted to learn more about wine, so I got a job at Fess Parker Winery when I was a freshman in college, and saw that there was actually degrees in viticulture and enology that were words that I had never even heard, or my previous counselors in Colorado had ever told me about. And I started researching schools and talking to my dad's friends in the industry, and found out the two best schools, or two of the best schools arguably in the world for viticulture and enology, are in California, Fresno State and UC Davis. I got into both schools, but Fresno State was the only winery that had a full working winery on campus at the time. And so I decided to go to Fresno for my career, to start off my schooling there. And I was working at the winery during the day and getting my hands dirty, and you know, my first true harvest after Fess Parker, and getting my theoretical understanding of it in the classroom. And during that time, I fell in love with Bordeaux varietals and had essentially spent the remaining part of my career up until I started my own label and started making wine for other folks, trying to work with the best wineries I possibly could, studying with the best estates and terroir. And fortunate, worked all over the world, from Argentina, for Paul Hobbs, and for the Argiano and Sasakaya families at their small little projects at Bodega Naomia and Bodega Chakra in Patagonia, Argentina. For winemakers like Bob Foley, who was a winemaker for Pride for many years, I was working on his own projects, Hourglass, Switchback Ridge, and kind of got to travel all over. And when I came back from Bordeaux, I was working at Screaming Eagle, and that's when I started Aperture. And this was back in 2009, and I had always been working all over the world, but I really saw, as we started to get these warmer and warmer vintages, there was amazing unique soil types, and the climate was a little bit more temperate and a little bit cooler, certainly in the evenings, on the Sonoma side for Bordeaux varietals. And that's really what drew me over to this side. And we started the label back in 2009 as just one Cabernet, a very, very small production. But we started to set some of the records for Cabernets coming out of Alexander Valley and Sonoma County. And I later was recruited from Screaming Eagle to be the director of winemaking at Lancaster Estate. And during that time period, brought me over to the Sonoma side. So I really got to expand my knowledge and understanding of the terroir throughout Sonoma County, but in particular, Alexander Valley. And that is when I really fell in love and saw the potential out here. So I started searching for these unique sites, started taking over more and more. And in 2015, had the opportunity to quit my day job of making wine for other folks. I still consult for other brands, and see how much debt I could get into and really take Aperture to the next level. And so found an amazing site where I'm sitting right now, which is the old Ponzo Ranch, one of Ridge's first single vineyard Zinfandels ever. It's a 40-acre parcel. The initial vines planted on here were planted in 1912. And we redeveloped a lot of the sites here because we had some, it was planted from 1912 to 1990. There was a stretch in there that they had a must have gotten a lot of virus Zinfandel vines. So we ripped out all those youthful vines. We kept the two blocks that were planted in 1912. And I brought out a soil scientist that I've worked with from Screaming Eagle to Lancaster days, Paul Anamosa, who did 56 soil pits for us throughout this area. Our viticulturist, Phil Fries, Dr. James Stamps, and kind of really wanted to do a deep dive into this site. And although we're in the Russian River AVA here, we are planting all Bordeaux varietals and clones that I'd really kind of throughout the whole property here. We have in the back a little bit more clay where we've got some clones and clippings from Chateau Yquem for our Semillon. And we're not going to go for a Sauternes style, but really to kind of continue to drive the Bordeaux Blanc style and make it in a dry barrel fermented wine to be blended in with our Sauvignon Blanc. And then as you start to get up here, it's actually where I'm sitting. This is at the top of the property. We have a lot of volcanic soils that are much, in my mind, better suited for Cabernet and Malbec. And in the middle, we have this beautiful section of blue clay, which is famous in Pomerol, in particular at Petrus. And we've got clones that they were planting out there from Petrus that we planted in the blue clay section out here.
So I have to ask you a couple questions. I mean, I have worked with a lot of winemakers around the world, and it's always, there's an insanity to your breed in that I feel like you guys like to be punished. I actually think you like it. I am convinced that if the weather was good every year, you guys would all just quit. And
what's the fun? My
question is, have you ever seen anything like this interfere with winemaking? A virus shutting down the world? I mean, it's not really directly affecting the wine. It's not hail. It's not, you know, a fire. It's not, you know, there was an earthquake in Napa. But this is something totally, I couldn't have even dreamt of this situation. Have you ever heard anything like this?
No, nor could I have ever dreamt anything like this as well. And certainly it's affected a lot of our different kind of ways we interact with people and our customer base. And we're still very fortunate we can ship wines direct to people's homes, because as we all know, everyone's drinking a lot of wines. And so fortunate in that sense. On the winemaking side and the vineyard side, we're considered an essential business. So the winemaking team, and it's a small team here, it's three people under me. We have not missed a beat. We're still bottling. And, you know, it's changed the way we bottle, where everyone's in masks and gloves now. And in the winery, we're able to keep social distance because of the space of wine and how, you know, it's kind of more, instead of doing team projects, each person kind of has their own project. So it's more projects that take a longer period of time. And in the vineyard, that's kind of like my sobering spot to go to, because out there, the vines are waking up and it's like nothing has changed for them. And you can kind of see the life cycle that always goes on for them out there continues. We're cultivating the cover crop. We're going through and suckering right now. And it's been beautiful weather out here. So the vines are just taking off. So that is kind of where I get back to, you know, hopefully this sense of things will get back to normal at some point, is being in the vineyards where they don't know a pandemic's going on. It's business as usual, their life cycle, they're waking up. There's subtleties in the vintage. And, you know, we've got some rains towards the end of, as the vines were starting to wake up. We've had these really warm weather, so they're starting to take off right now. We had an incredibly high cover crop that we've now put back into the soils. But so there's subtleties, but no different than any subtleties of any other vintage. But then when you step back from that and kind of look at what's going on a global level, it can be quite overwhelming.
It's just astounding to me the amount of things that are thrown at you, having to deal with nature and people and business. And I want to transition into the business of this, because a lot of people don't, you know, they may know you as somebody behind making one of the most expensive bottles in history. Or what was the most expensive bottle you've sold? Is that correct?
Yeah,
this is a very interesting moniker to hold on to. I want to know how this came about.
Sure. Yeah, we set the Guinness Book of World Record for most expensive bottle of wine ever sold, 750 bottle. There's been larger formats that have sold for higher, but for one single bottle, 750 milliliters. And this was the first time ever this was done by a wine from Sonoma County as well. This was a Alexander Valley Cabernet, a single vineyard cab from SJ Ranch. And this was in partnership. And what was even more exciting about this is 100% of the proceeds went to an amazing charity for children through Emeril Lagasse Foundation. And this was a partnership. I've done a few of these fun, high-profile celebrity labels, almost all of them having some element of charitable giving and philanthropy tied into with it. And this one as well. And this was a partnership with a guy by the name of Shep Gordon. And if, for those who don't know Shep, there's a great documentary, you can get it online, called Supermensch. And it's produced by Mike Myers. And Shep, for those who might not know him as a household name, has been behind the scenes of a lot of the cultural elements of the last four decades. He was the manager of Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin, Alice Cooper, and then a lot of the celebrity chefs that are in our culture today attribute their success to Shep, because he really came up with the identity of celebrity chef, Emeril Lagasse being one of the first ones. And Shep is this brilliant mind who really thought about bringing chefs from the back of the house to the front of the house to show the unique personalities and identities of each of these individual chefs. And Emeril, obviously being one of his most successful clients, we decided, I made one barrel of wine for Shep, which was a custom bottle, custom blend just for Shep. He gave a lot of them out to his, you know, A-list celebrity group. And then he does a holiday party that does give a lot back to charity over New Year's. and we had three bottles left, and Shep gave one to the Emeril Lagasse Foundation, and it ended up setting the Guinness Book of World Records and selling for $350,000 that evening, which was beyond an honor and really fun project to work on, obviously.
First of all, I mean, it's a good marketing because it's for charity. I mean, it really is. And it's very different than this wine just went for $350,000 and some collector put it in their basement, you know?
Yeah.
So what does that do for you as a winemaker? Do people go, oh, I need to try this guy's wine because he did this? Or is it just you've moved on? I mean, it's...
No. We're always trying to kind of push the envelope as far as it goes, not only in winemaking and viticulturally, but also in different ways of getting to new people and introducing our wines, because we are still a very, very small boutique brand across all the products that I work on. And I was at home. I was supposed to be at the Carnival de Vin where this auction happened. And my mom, who still lives in Boulder, Colorado, came out to visit me. So I stayed back in Sonoma and stayed here with her, and we were sitting at dinner during this auction, and all of a sudden my phone just keeps on buzzing, and I'm like, excuse myself from dinner, and I pick it up, and it's first call was Fox News, and then it was Esquire and People Magazine and all these publications that are certainly outside of the wine realm. So it was a really interesting way to get a new breath of eyes on us that is outside of the normal bubble of PR and press that we normally get. And so that was exciting, and it kind of tied into a lot of the other projects that I had done, from Jessica Biel and Justin Timberlake's wedding wine, and kind of tied into all these different cultural elements that wine and food, for that matter, kind of interact with. And it's shortly after that, like ESPN did that big thing about all these different athletes that are no longer bragging about their watches or their cars, but about what bottles of wines they're bringing to these parties. And kind of the cultural element that wine has evolved into is really exciting, and exciting to be a little part of that as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's cool. I think it's an interesting statement on just the value of wine, though, and what it costs. And it's I always find wine to be this very tricky thing because it's expensive to make. I mean, the process of making wine is not that expensive, but you have to house it in a building, and that land is expensive, and especially if you're in America. But then there's also things where it's more than just the wine. I mean, thinking Screaming Eagle. I mean, Screaming Eagle is a wine that it's expensive because it's good. Sure, but it's also expensive for 10 other reasons. I mean, it's market, and I'm always interested in this. How does somebody come up with the cost of a wine? And I'm curious your thoughts on it. I mean, is it based on what it costs to make? Is it based on demand? I mean, I know it's based on all those things, but...
That's a complex question because...
And do you want your wine to be expensive? As a winemaker, is that something you want? I'm curious.
Well, it's a tough question because, like, if it's raising a huge amount of money for charity, absolutely. You know, I do a lot of these different charitable auctions and stuff, and the bigger your auction goes, the more exciting it is, and the more money you're able to raise for these spectacular charities. One of the other goals of mine of coming over to create, you know, a luxury Cabernet house on the Sonoma side was that we could also offer wines of similar quality on the Sonoma side for a little bit less expensive. And so our wines certainly aren't inexpensive by any stretch of the imagination, but if you look at them in their peer set, a lot of them are in comparison as far as when you look at top wines, scoring, auctions, whatever it may be, we're often related to many of the wines from Napa. And because we're on the Sonoma side and vineyard land is less expensive, if you purchase it by the ton, is less expensive than Napa, and sometimes like half of the price, we're able to make a wine of the same level of winemaking, the quality, the optical sorting, and the attention to detail in the vineyards and all those viticultural practices that usually, those are the things that really drive up the cost of the wine. A lot of that is in the vineyard, but at a price point that's usually, you know, a third to half the price of a lot of these bottles that we're being compared to.
So when you go out, yeah, no, and that's very apparent. I've had your wines. They are incredibly well made.
Thank you.
It's when you go for a review from, you know, Wine Spectator or Advocate or anything, and obviously as a winemaker, you want the highest score possible. What do you do? Do you just send them wine and hold your breath and go, I hope, or do you lobby, or how does that process work?
It really depends. The more and more eyes and acclaim that we've been getting, a lot of the critics will actually come out to our winery and I'll take them through the vineyards and kind of give them a little bit of the backstory and show them what we're doing viticulturally. Show them the winery that we were able to produce in 2019 was our first vintage buried a bottle at the new winery, which is truly one of the most state-of-the-art wineries on the planet. There's no place on this world that I'd rather make wine at than what I created here. There might be wineries that have better sculptures or more unique stuff as far as finishes and stuff, but for quality, there was no expense spared for that. And so it's, I think, important to bring those critics and wine writers through to the process of knowing that we have a thought behind every step of the process, of the viticultural elements, the winemaking, and we're not this brand that is buying bulk, buying, you know, random grapes on the bulk market, making it at random facilities. Every single decision we make is for the quality of the wine. Every vineyard, every berry that goes into any of my wines, it's usually my team farming it, but we have all full control of all viticultural elements of that. Whenever they give us official reviews, that's all behind closed doors, and we don't really know what happens. We send them the wine, and you know, we have confidence in our wines that they'll showcase when they do. So the control I have is I don't send them until I think they're ready. We always release them to our mailing list first. Every single vintage, whether I love to showcase vintage uniqueness each year, I don't want to make the same wine every year, but whether it's a super warm year or a difficult year, whatever it may be, whatever I put in a bottle will be something very unique and spectacular. And so we have a very, very long list of devoted and trustworthy members that they don't really care that much about the scores. And so if we get a massive score on one of our wines, it's already been offered to them. They pick up those wines. And then we see people come in and come out who are chasing scores a little bit more.
Do the scores still have the same impact they used to have? I mean, do they still move the needle the same way, or now, or do you have to kind of think about social? Is it all where? How do you sell wine now, I guess, is the question, because there was a point where scores were everything.
Yeah, I think scores are part of the story, and you know, I don't make wine, and you'll hear this from a lot of winemakers, but I don't make wine to make for one palate who's rating the wines. I make wines for wines that I love to enjoy, and that a style that we've kind of created of making these wines that are, you know, new world fruit of these big, rich, lush Bordeaux varietals that so many people fall in love with California for. But because of those cooler sites that we're working with, we have a little bit more elegance, a little bit more brightness, and a little bit more freshness. And that's the style of wine that I love. And that's the wines that I was introduced to and that I think are better with pairings. So to me, yes, scores are important just to show your consistency. And, you know, every single wine critic who's tasted any of our Cabernets throughout the years, we've always been very, very consistent. And so that's, I think, I'm most proud of, that we're not getting these massive scores from one critic and horrible scores. Across the board, we're all getting amazing, you know, 90+++ point scores. But I think what's been more impactful for us and how we've really created the brand is, because of our wines having so much richness and texture and to the wines, but still, like I was saying, have a little bit more freshness and brightness in them, is working with great chefs, sommeliers, and restaurateurs. And what better way to get introduced to wines than if you're sitting at a new restaurant and that sommelier brings up this bottle of wine perfectly paired with that dish, and all of a sudden you'll have this amazing experience. And this day and age, you take a photo of that wine and all of a sudden you can get on our list and buy it directly from us. That is really the way I've built the brand. And outside of harvest, I'm spending a lot of time, well, not anymore, on the road, talking with people. And I think it certainly has changed, because the scoring, there are so many great winery brands out there and the scores are a little bit more convoluted than they used to be, that it certainly is a piece of the puzzle. But it used to be, if you got a huge score, you'd sell it instantly. That's certainly not the case anymore.
Yeah, it's an interesting process. And I can only imagine how many times you have to pivot. Even though you haven't been a winemaker for 40, 50 years, the pivot process seems to be much faster now. All of a sudden, there's a new social media platform. In the case of Sideways, a movie can come along and just totally change the atmosphere.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, you have to be standing there looking out across the hill the whole time. You don't just get to be a farmer is what I guess I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I think the key thing, and one of the things that I'm very proud of for myself and my team, is we've always really stuck with what we are passionate about and what we're good at. And there might be new trends with new varietals and new styles of wine and, you know, changing what kind of style your winemaking is due to fit some trend that's going on. And we've always just really kind of tried to focus on the quality and pushing the our boundaries of what we can do for our style and our vineyards. And I think that, as you see with the test of time, will be what will be our strength in the long run. So we're making the best wine from the sites that we have and focusing on that. And we're fortunate that that has been received incredibly well.
Yeah, no, I think that's the best answer you can give for that. I mean, it's a, and you can do a lot worse than Bordeaux varietals. You know, Malbec and blends and things that you're doing are, you know, you can, you still have the ability to have your signature in there and change the blends and deal with vintage. And, you know, it's, Bordeaux varietals are not going to go out of, they're not going to go out of fashion. It's just not going to happen.
No, I agree. And the Bordeaux varietals gives you a lot of flexibility, especially as you have different Bordeaux blends. And one of the things that we decided to create a whole brand off of was single vineyard dry farm Malbecs from California and under a brand called Devil Proof. And when I was creating this kind of luxury tier of Malbecs, 2012, the first vintage that it came out, everyone thought I was crazy because, you know, Cabernet was king and things were so popular with that. But I had,
and there's so much Malbec coming in from South America that's so inexpensive. So you have to compete right away, right?
Absolutely. Well, what Argentina and South America have done for Malbec has made it a household name. But what they've also done is made it this varietal that they think is this kind of non-distinct entry-level red wine that's relatively inexpensive. I was fortunate because I worked two different vintages in Argentina, one for Paul Hobbs at his winery there, Vinicobos, which are these spectacular world-class, big, rich, powerful Malbecs that can sit on the, any table of great Bordeaux wines that I've had.
We just got back from filming there.
I mean,
like literally right as the country was shutting down for COVID, we were flying back here. So
amazing. Yeah. So you saw, and you've had those wines, and these wines are absolutely spectacular and are not the Malbecs that most people think coming out of Argentina. And prior to that, the vintage before that, I worked for Bodega Naomia, which is Naomi Cinzano, from who used to own Argiano, and Hans Vinding, one of my very, very dear friends now after working for him. And these wines are biodynamic, old vine Malbec in Patagonia, Argentina. Again, these aren't inexpensive wines. They're a few hundred dollars a bottle, but these wines are world class to consider the dinner table with any of the great Bordeaux from California, from Bordeaux, from France, and so on. And so when I came back to California, I'd used Malbec throughout my tenure as blenders into a lot of the great wines that I'd made throughout Napa and Sonoma. But I really wanted to showcase what we could do as a single bottling of it. And that was my inspiration behind that, and not go for inexpensive, which a lot of people who were making the varietal at this time were kind of going for that inexpensive to mid-tier range. I wanted to go to the top and try to showcase what we could do and showcase that we can make some of the best, if not the best Malbecs in the world here in California. With our Malbec, from the very first vintage, 2012 on, we've been the highest rated Malbec in the history of California from every single critic who's ever tasted it. And last year, our current release of the Devil Proof Malbec, Robert Parker's Wine Advocate said, hands down, the finest Malbec we've ever tasted, period. And it happens to be from Sonoma. So,
well, that helps.
those kind of quotes. And that's when scores do change. And yeah, we sold out pretty quickly of that wine.
What does this Malbec sell for? What is Malbec? What is your...
We sell all of that through our list, and that's for $150. But if you go to the online platforms, it's usually selling for about $225 to $275, depending on the vintage.
Wow. That's amazing. I mean, that does definitely redefine what a lot of people would think about Malbec. Now, I happen to think it's a very maligned, but also... You know, the grape is wonderful. I like it. I think from a value standpoint, all the way up to what you can do with it on a luxury level, it's pretty amazing.
Absolutely,
what that grape can do. But it's a low yielding grape. I mean, it's a pain in the ass.
Viticulture, it's a huge pain in the ass because it can have these massive canopies as well. The leaves are the largest for any of the Bordeaux varietals, and so making sure your canopy is combed and you're not getting a lot of shading in the middle part of the canopy, so those leaves are dying and sitting all those pyrazines into the fruit. And then at the same time, it is low yielding due to the fact, for the high level, due to the fact that it sets these relatively large clusters, especially if you're looking in the five major Bordeaux varietals, and it can have these wings that are almost the same size of the main cluster. And so we have to go through usually three times to go through and cut off wings, manicure the fruit so it's not bunched up and touching one another, so it's all separate. So by the time we're done with it, yeah, the yields are pretty low. And if you don't do that, that's when you get these kind of nondescript red wines. And I think why a lot of people don't really understand what the varietal characteristics of Malbec can be, is because if you don't do any canopy management, you're going to get a lot of those green flavors because the middle part of the canopy will inevitably start to die, turn yellow, and send that green flavor, those pyrazines, into the fruit characteristics. And also, if you don't manicure the fruit, you're going to have a lot of variation of ripening throughout, even within the same vine, let alone the same block. Malbec's done well that are planted well, and we dry farm all of our Malbecs. We really try to kind of stress them out and really focus the ripening and the concentration on the fruit characteristics. You have a wine that has very similar elements of a lot of the great Cabernets you would think of here, as far as the richness, the texture, but the tannins are a little bit different, the aromatics are different, and you have, in most cellars that are Cabernet lovers, I'm guilty of this as well, you go into my cellar, it's Napa Cabs and Bordeaux is that majority. And there's so many great Napa Cabs and Sonoma Cabs and California Cabs coming out right now. To have a wine that has a lot of those elements that you love in those varietals and those wines, but has a little bit different aromatics, a little bit different texture to the wine, I think is a fun play on. And I often put it into blind tastings with other Cabernets. And people are always like, what is this? Because there's a spice and there's a floralness to it that you'd often, if ever, find in a lot of the Cabernets out there.
And it's very fascinating stuff. It is very cool to talk to you about all of this. I'm hoping that, you know, the audience we have, if they haven't heard of you, I doubt they haven't, but if they haven't, I hope that they try this wine offering. So Jesse, tell me about the wines people can get. These are great pairings with seafood.
Amazing. So Kyle, who's obviously one of the featured chefs for the new Delicacy movie, decided on these two wines because obviously the amazing seafood that he's using to pair with. And so he went with the two aromatic white wines that I make that are both barrel fermented. First being our barrel fermented Chenin Blanc. And this is a really cool wine from one of the oldest dry farm Chenin Blanc vineyards out in Clarksburg. These vineyards were planted back in the 40s, dry farming, meaning there's zero irrigation whatsoever. The only water these vines get is what Mother Nature gives to them on an annual basis. And it really produces these wines of incredible aromatics and concentration and beauty, but there's that beautiful acidity that kind of ties it all through. These vines really won't ripen much more. They kind of start shutting down around 22 and a half Brix. So finished alcohols are always right around 12.5%, 13% alcohol, but it holds that acidity. But we want to kind of accentuate that tension in the wine. And so this is all barrel fermented as well, but no new oak barrels whatsoever. It's 50% in neutral French oak barrels and 50% in stainless steel barrels. So really just to create texture and do a lot of lees work, we're doing a lot of batonnage, stirring the barrels on like a weekly basis towards the end of fermentation, and then monthly during the aging process. And again, just to build the texture of the wine, we really wanted to showcase this unique vineyard site for Chenin Blanc. And what's paired with that for this offering that we're going to send directly to folks' homes is the first wine, white wine I have ever made for Aperture, which is our barrel fermented Sauvignon Blanc. And this is really inspired from my time in Bordeaux. During that time, while I was mainly studying in the right bank of Bordeaux at Petrus, I got to spend a lot of time on the left bank while my father was doing his book called The Club of Nine, which started off as the five first growths on the left bank and evolved to Petrus, Cheval Blanc, and Chateau Ozone on the right bank, and the one winery in Sauternes, Chateau Yquem, that was included in this bunch. It's an unofficial term that I didn't even know about it, but all those nine wineries have this kind of coalition that they work on different projects together, and kind of obviously some of the premier wines to come out of the world. I went to Bordeaux to study the red wines and came back with a whole new appreciation for Sauvignon Blanc, Semillon, and that was my inspiration behind this wine. So this is Sauvignon Blanc and Semillon, just a splash of Semillon in the 2019 vintage, about 4%. And this is all from the coldest vineyard site that I work with, which is Dry Stack Vineyard out in Bennett Valley. Just a spectacular site. And this is a wine that has just incredible tension. The new oak barrels on this, there's about a third new oak, but it's not going to be oaky by any sense. It's adding a spice and a richness and a complexity to this wine. 10% of the barrels that go into this are barrels that I saw at Aubryon that I couldn't find anywhere in the United States, which are actually French oak bodies of the barrel. But the heads of the barrel are all acacia wood. And they have this toasted acacia wood, and they're made specifically for Aubryon in their in-house cooperage there. And I started searching for them and actually had to have them sent over from Bordeaux specifically for this wine. but this has such bright natural acidity. I never acidify any of my wines. And that barrel regime and the Semillon give a little bit more oily richness characteristics to this style. And although this is made in a Bordeaux Blanc style, it's certainly New World fruit. There's a lot of like pear, peach, melon, but that kind of acidity again kind of creates this amazing tension in the wine. And so Kyle just flipped out over this, and I think this is kind of one of his features for the special seafoods that are coming from the delicacy feature.
Oh, yeah, no question. That Sauvignon Blanc in particular is really, really, really good. Really, really good. I've drank way more of it than I want to admit.
The depletions have been high in my household recently as well.
Yeah, I'm sure. It's tough not to run out of wine right now. So for just to wrap up on the wine offering, so those two bottles of wine, a recipe by who I think is arguably one of the greatest chefs in America.
Same.
Who's also in the film. Yeah. It's a seafood hot pot, and you can also order abalone from Monterey Abalone. They farm sustainably, and your wines are done very sustainably, and a portion of this goes to charity as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's going to help a lot of the locals here, and actually nationwide, that have lost their jobs, and to help provide meals during this difficult time. The recipe that he created for that will be sent to you are ingredients that you'll be able to find at your local grocery store. He has a couple of these cool add-ons that will, you know, if you wanted to order the uni from some of these amazing sustainable local providers. I love to cook. I'm not a good cook by any means, and it's something that I'm even able to do in my basic skill set. So it's a really, really fun package and a way to kind of create this unique meal, have these amazing wines, and watch this premiere of this movie that we were hoping to do here, but I can't wait to watch it myself. I'm hoping to watch it tonight.
Great. Love this, man. So we'll have that link up on all of our social media. You know, so if you go to any of the Somm Film social media or Somm TV, you'll be able to find the link for this. And we'll be talking quite a bit about it in the lead up of this film.
Great. And until we can get you all out here to the hospitality space, we'll send these wines to you, have Kyle create a unique dish, and hopefully raise a lot of money for charity as well.
Really appreciate it. This is great, Jesse. I look forward to talking again.
Thanks so much. Talk soon and hope to see you soon. But until then, stay safe.
All right, love it.
Bye, everyone.
Thanks so much for joining us. Don't forget, Somm TV has a 7-day free trial right now, so you can try it for free. Go to SommTV.com. You can log in on almost any device worldwide and watch it from your smart TV, your iPad. You can watch it on the toilet. You can watch it with your dog in the doghouse. You can watch it wherever you're quarantining right now. SommTV.com. And don't forget, our blind tasting-based card game is available at blindersgame.com. We're taking pre-orders, and that will ship when it gets here, hopefully in the next 3 weeks. So I hope you enjoy that. Until then, thank you so much, and we will see you at Somm TV. Bye-bye.